Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Bula, namaste, noae Māori. Thank you for tuning into ABC Radio Australia. O tō asa le live mō vono, by which I mean it is a pleasure to bring you Pacific Beat on Fridays from the islands. We are broadcasting on the lands of the Matangalio Suvivo in the Vanua Onondonumai in Fiji's capital. Wherever you are in the beautiful big blue Bulavinaka, I'm getting ready to bring you the top stories from the Wasa Pacifica. And today's headlines: Samoa's Prime Minister says his government will draft legislation requiring members of parliament to undergo drug testing. Fiji's finance minister will release the national budget this morning and will be getting an analysis of what's to be expected. Today, Tonga is celebrating 200 years since Christianity was established in the kingdom. This is my last Friday in a while to host Pacific Beat from Fiji, so thank you for joining us. Stay with us. I am Live Movono, your host today in Fiji, and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. In Tonga, today we're marking a major milestone of 200 years since Christianity was first established in the kingdom in 1826. Christianity is deeply woven into Tongan life, culture, and identity. But what was Tonga like before the arrival of the first missionaries? And what impact has it had on the nation over the past two centuries? To help us understand this important chapter of Tonga's history, we're joined by the Tongan Wesleyan historian and lecturer in theology, Reverend Paula Latu in Tonga. Maloelele, faifakau, Paula Latu. Thank you for joining us.
I take this opportunity to share my views on the history of Tonga and especially the history of Christianity 200 years. In simple terms, the end of the 18th century marks the end of the Tongan Empire and was the darkest and most troublesome times for Tonga internally. Following the assassinations of key figures and sparking a civil war that lasted half a century, three royal dynasties contested for powers and dominance. The people did not have an answer for those challenges. So the arrival of Christianity was the light the country needed. It provided a framework for His Majesty King Dubodo I, who invited the country to streamline its political and governing structures together, weaving peace and prosperity as we know today. And it was the dawn of a new beginning, a new light of hope, not just for Tonga, but for the region. Marabito.
Malo and Vinaka Vakalevu, Reverend, you took me right to heaven this morning. Thank you so much for that brief history into how Christianity first arrived in Tonga. But tell me, what was Tonga like before Christianity arrived in 1826, Reverend?
Prior to 1826, Tonga was known as a territorial and maritime empire, controlling much of the region. It was a center for traditional celebrations and cultural festivities, a symbol of power that was revered throughout the Pacific.
So why is this anniversary so important to everyday Tongans right now?
Before Christianity, Tonga was, and much of the Pacific, worshipped different deities from ancient Tongan mythologies. We learn from the Tongan cosmology of the three-day world, namely the Langi, sky, Fonua, land, and a lot of them were underworld. They recited the Tangalo gods in the sky. Hikuleo, the goddess, resided in the Mercury world, controlling the Fonua, the land, and Maui gods resided in the underworld, controlling the fire, created lands through volcano eruptions from the deep. And of course, the islanders worshipped other gods of lesser importance. So this three-decked world came forth the Atuitonga dynasty, said to be descended from Tangaloa at Matapua, who came down from the sky and cohabited an earthly woman and gave rise to the first Tuitonga, namely Aetu, who was revered as God in place by the general population of Tonga. It was evident in the way the people of different lineages celebrated the Inasi festival and each tribe of the Pacific Islands that were under dominance of the Tuitonga Empire had to travel to Tonga to sing, to dance, and to feast, to celebrate and make offerings to the Tuitonga whom they saw as a divine fika. People of those days made offerings of food, both produces from their farm, sacrificed livestock, best catch from their fishing at sea, mats, fine arts, and ngatu, tablecloth, tapohat canoes, weapon, land, and anything that was valuable to society was offered as sacrifice to the Tuitonga as supreme ruler of the empire and representation of the fertility god. The Tuitonga descended, from the Tuitonga descended two other kingships, namely Tuihatakalaua and Hatukanukupolo dynasty. Today's king, Tupouono, is the 78th king in the succession of that long-standing kingships in the oral history of Tonga. New Zealand historian Ian Campbell, book published in 1989, titled Tongan Classical Kingships, tells it all. Thank you.
Reverend, tell me, who were the key people that helped spread Christianity throughout Tonga, and what sort of difficulties did they face in those early years?
Well, thank you for that very good question. There were four key landings of missionaries in the kingdom. First, the London Missionary Society landed in 1797. But so 10 workers were welcomed by Tuikanapolo Mumui and distributed to various chiefs for security and support. Three of those missionaries, sadly, together with one English sailor, died during the Civil War of 1799. Sadly, as I said, these innocent men were accidentally killed by the Hifo warriors during the war because they were not able to supply the warriors with what they needed at the time for warfare. They became the martyrs of Christian faith in Tonga, as the early church theologian Deuterium of Carthage says, the blood of martyrs, the seed of the church. Secondly, the landing of Wesleyan minister Reverend Walter Laurie and his wife Mary Ethel Laurie at Moa, 16th of August 1822, welcomed by Fatui Motulalo, the son of the Molikiha Amoya, the last Tuihatakalaua, who died at Tekiu during the Civil War of 1799. The only achievement that Laurie made in Tonga was the landing of the Christian Bible with daily home church services at the mission house in Moa, which Laurie accordingly named as Co-Governor the First. Prince Tungi offered a book about this history, and it was published this year. The third landing was by John Thomas and John Hutchinson in Hihifo, welcomed by Chief Hata of Kanakapolo Dynasty in 1826. This was the source of the country's adoption of Christianity in Wesleyan tradition. Hutchinson and Thomas started a home church and a home school, namely Nazareth, at the mission house at Coquemanops II at Ameloke Hihifo. Although Ata parted with the missionaries after 2.5 years of welcoming them to live in his domain, Ata's neighbor, namely Chief Aume'e, welcomed the missionaries together with Wahai at Fa'ui, take the missionaries to town to Nukalofa to meet the king at the time, who was Tuikanukupolo Chief King Sosaiale Motu'a. Her Majesty Queen Nanasipa authored a book titled Kofi Manuel II, Book of Fihifo, was published in 2016. The fourth lending is the Catholic Mission, who lended the Bible in Tonga in the 1840s. The first successful lending and permanent settlement of Catholic priests in Tonga occurred on July the 1st, 1842. It was led by Bishop Sean Baptiste Bompalia, and the Annals of Propagation of Faith tell the whole story. This was the dawn of a new light, the king, chiefs, and people of Tonga celebrating today.
Vinaka, and can you talk to me about the kind of changes, the kind of impact and influence that Christian faith had over Tongan traditional culture and traditions and even leadership?
Thank you very much. Tonga has always adopted different ways and practices from other cultures to enhance our culture and our way of living and also our leadership. For example, from the Bible, His Majesty to first modernized his island kingdom using biblical principles. To Bolwagi dedicated Tonga to the living God in 1839, codified customary laws in the same year, and also form up a government. And also, this is evident in the motive of the 1875 Constitution of Tonga, as it reads, and I'm quoting, "It appears to be the will of God for all Tongans to be free." And by that, the Constitution is founded on accounting to the ultimate will of the living God. Tongan borrowed from European formal education, the way of learning. However, Tongan Professor Kunai Helothamen reminds us that Pacific education is the introduction of introduction to worthwhile learning, and worthwhile learning includes non-formal and informal realities in its own indigenous formalities. Not only that, but Tongan culture, Tongan hiva and faiwa were non-formal ways of learning for Tongan people. We borrow some of the faiwa from our neighboring islands. We borrow kailau from the Fiji war dance, and Tongan taolunga is said to be of the Samoan siwa and the simulation of bad moments. Today, we see taolunga being well performed by the princess of the royal family, and these faiwa are performed when they came to perform to the tu'i at the Katoanga. So the whole occasion is a real learning for all, and also our tradition, food delicacies originated elsewhere, but it is now a core part of our culture, not only of our culture, but also our celebration and our thanksgiving to God. Much like Christianity, we have interwoven Christianity to our culture to enhance our way of life, disregarding mystical beliefs and values, and aligning with Christian values and biblical fruits of the Spirit. The Christian theology of God, the incarnation of Jesus Christ, have been adopted to displace the heart of our Tongan culture and missioning cross of Jesus Christ as the center of every cultural occasion. King Dubowraki liberated the common people from the rule of the kings and the chiefs and issued an Emancipation Act in 1862 that marked a Christian act of freedom. The king inaugurated and promulgated a written constitution, establishing a constitutional monarchical government in 1875. Dubowraki also established schools. Had the initiative of establishing schools in 1866, and the government college in 1882. The king also instituted independent Tongan Church Conference in 1885.
Talatala, thank you so much for all of that history and the celebration of 200 years of Christianity in the kingdom. Just lastly, a message that you would like to share with the people across the Pacific, especially the younger generations, about the role of faith in today's world.
Thank you so much. I'd have the message that any Christian minister would have: repent and abide with Jesus Christ, our Lord and our Savior. As a citizen of this island kingdom, our motto is Koyotua Motonga Kontofia. God and Tonga are inheritances. Our ultimate task as Christians is to primarily save souls. It does not take much to recognize the legacy of Christianity in Tonga all of the time, but all of Tonga's successes in the past 200 years is credited with the cutting light of Christianity, which is realized in the landing of the Holy Bible on our shores 200 years ago, the Pentecostal revival occurred in Tonga. Papa was king in 1834, who in turn formed governments and also codified laws and also dedicated the whole kingdom to God. So our take on this is to beg everyone that we need to accept Jesus Christ as our Lord and our Savior. And it's our wish that we all attain the Pacific with Jesus Christ. Malaupito
and Vinakavakalevu. That was the Tongan Wesleyan historian and lecturer in theology, Reverend Paula Latu, speaking to me from the Kingdom of Tonga.
Disasters are a reality of life in the Pacific, but so is the strength and resilience of its people. Pacific Prepared shares first-hand stories from communities on the ground, drawing on tradition, culture, and collective wisdom to stay safe and support one another in times of disaster. Pacific Prepared explores how communities are adapting and protecting what matters most. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Samoa's Prime Minister says his government will draft legislation requiring members of parliament to undergo drug testing. The announcement followed a heated exchange in parliament on the issue after the speaker ordered MPs to subject themselves to testing. Former Prime Minister Fiamia Naomi Mataafa raised the ire of the government by questioning the speaker's authority to require tests. She wanted to know what the consequences would be for refusing to be tested and potentially returning a positive result. Samoa reporter Adele Fruin has the story.
Like many Pacific nations, the impact of illicit drugs, particularly the use of methamphetamines, is a growing issue in Samoa. This week, Prime Minister Laulilimali Toablatevo Fosi Schmidt told Parliament the plan to drug test MPs follows a government directive requiring all public servants to be tested as part of a wider effort to eliminate drugs.
The issue of drug testing has already been officially announced to the nation, beginning with government employees under the Public Service Commission. This new mandate requires all public servants to undergo testing, reflecting the government's concern over the current rise in drug use. It has been formally declared that every government worker must comply, and the program will expand in the future to include everyone.
The Prime Minister says the announcement is not new. It has been broadcasted for all of Samoa to hear. He says MPs should lead by example, as he has done.
I was the first to take the drug test to officially launch this initiative because I believe the nation must see the seriousness of the current situation. We must rise together to save Samoa.
But his predecessor, Fiamia Naomi Mataafa, had some questions.
As a parliamentary representative, I wish to understand the statement you made, whether the drug testing of MPs will be mandatory or voluntary. I fully recognise the government's commitment to eradicating the rise and spread of illegal drug use in our country.
Fiamia wanted to know what would happen if an MP refused to take a test, the consequences if they returned a positive result, and under what authority could the government make tests mandatory for MPs.
Honourable Speaker of the House, what are the consequences if I choose not to take the test? Would it affect my position as an MP? Secondly, if this is the start where if the government or yourself says we have to do this and we do it, where do we draw the line? Today it is drug testing. Tomorrow it could be another kind of test. Yet it is unclear what foundation or authority supports these measures.
The mayor also asked how drug testing MPs would help to eliminate drugs in Samoa. The Speaker of the House, Awapa'au Mulipola Aloitafua, said politicians are not exempt from laws that affect everybody else, and told the mayor she can refuse to take the test if she wishes.
If your choice is that you do not want to do it, it reminds me of a saying in the Christian faith, where if you do not want to enter the church, that is your freedom under the constitution. But the nation is listening.
Prime Minister Laulien Maliator defended the speaker and said the mayor's questions were disappointing.
A concerned citizen
told you, the leader at the time, and us that government and police should address drugs. Was anything done? Nothing was done. Now the drug use is spreading rapidly and we are trying to eliminate it and we are met with resistance. They questioned why Parliament should be treated differently. We are all under the law. Test. To show sincerity and honesty to the public. If you don't want to test, what about the public servants? Who are you to say you don't want to get tested?
At the end of it all, the Prime Minister said the government would draw up a law requiring MPs to undergo drug tests rather than relying on a request from the Speaker. He didn't provide a timeline on when the bill would be presented to Parliament.
That was Adele Fruin reporting from Apia.
Pacific Beat.
Now to Fiji, where the country's hospitals need around 50 pints of blood every single day. But for years, families have been left to find their own donors when a loved one needs blood. This month, the Fiji Red Cross and the Ministry of Health are launching a national blood app they hope will change that. We met a young man who has spent his whole life depending on strangers for blood and the volunteer who keeps him alive. Siha Maharaj was born in Suva with a rare blood disorder. And for as long as the 21-year-old can remember, staying alive has meant a transfusion every week or two.
You know, I wake up and just getting out of bed feels exhausting. You know, getting in the shower is like almost a chore, which most people, I don't think, can imagine what that feels like.
Siha has thalassemia, a genetic disorder that means his body cannot make enough healthy blood. His blood type is O negative, the rarest, and every trip to hospital is a gamble on whether the blood bank will have what he needs.
You don't know what you're going to get. I don't know if I'm even going to receive that one bag of blood.
Fiji's blood system still relies on what's called replacement donation. When a patient needs blood, the hospital asks their family to go and find donors. Salote Maramaviriviri coordinates blood drives for the Fiji Red Cross.
The hospital asks the family to donate on behalf of their relatives or family members. So while they're looking for donors, they use the reserve that they have so that they're able to save lives. And then whoever comes in to donate replenishes that.
That search can turn desperate. And Siha says some people try to profit from it, demanding money, even a car, in return for blood.
They ask, how bad do you want this? Because I can do it today, and I know I'm O negative, but you got to give me something in return. You usually got to give me money. There was this one guy who asked for a car.
For 7 years, one man has stood between Siha and that uncertainty. Penny Nakora is an O negative donor, and he gave his own blood to Siha again and again.
I think I gave him blood for almost 6 to 7 years, about 7 years, I think, until, because I can't really recall when he actually switched groups into O negative, because when he was in O positive, I'd never miss a day to give him blood, because I know, I was like, okay, he needs it, I got it, I'll try and be the backup.
But Penny doesn't stop at his own blood. Several times a week, he drives from Suva to the west of Itilevu to collect other donors, often on no sleep.
Every time I get a call, I'll just travel. I'll go all the way down to the west, pick up the donors, take them to the nearest blood bank, donate them. And I usually do it in a week, maybe 4 or 5 times in a week. Just when I'm about to fall asleep, I'll park in the side of the road. I'll sleep for about 10 minutes and I'm driving again.
He pays his own costs. He does it, he says, because no one else will.
I do it because I have to. Because like, I do it, the reason why I do it is because if no one's going to do it, then who will, you know?
It is hoped the new Fiji Blood app will make Penny's volunteer work unnecessary. Donors register on their phones and the Red Cross can send alerts by location when blood is needed. Salote Maramaviriviri again.
Okay, once you download the app, you register yourself. The back end for us, it actually shows us that somebody has downloaded from a certain division. So it makes it easier for us when we're doing blood drives or pushing out alerts or needs for blood.
The app also lets donors book appointments and reminds them when they're due to give again. Salote says donations across Vitilevu reached more than 16,000 last year, but demand never stops, and shortages still bring calls in the middle of the night.
It's like you get calls in the middle of the night saying, would you be able to organize a blood drive tomorrow? We're having shortage of blood. So when they say shortage of blood, that means they really need blood.
The Fiji Blood app launches on the Google Play Store today, free to download. For Siha, who has spent his whole life depending on people he will never meet, the message is simple.
Always have hope. There's always good people who's willing to give it and expect nothing in return.
The Fiji Blood app will be launched later this morning at the Fiji Red Cross, and you can download it on Google Play Stores. That was Siha Maharaj ending that report.
Pacific Beat.
Australia is by far the largest aid donor to the Pacific Islands, accounting for 38% of total aid for the last 15 years. This dwarfs China's contribution of 9% over the same period. However, the annual Lowy Institute poll, which tracks Australian attitudes on foreign policy, tells a different narrative. According to 2,000 Australians surveyed, China, not Australia, is the most influential country in the Pacific Islands. The result is a reversal of last year's findings. And to find out why, Kyle Evans spoke with Lowy's director of its Pacific Islands program, Oliver Nobitau.
My view is it's probably an amalgamation of a couple of things. The first one is that there have been, I guess, over the last 12 months, some key actions that have been taken by China, which has really pushed them into the front of the news of Australian readers as well, which has given them a lot more prominence. The other could be that there's a broader perception of Australia's performance over the past few years is that it hasn't been as strong as it has been. There's been cost of living pressures that are facing ordinary Australians as well. And there's a broader perception that Australia is not as strong as it used to be. So when you're considering Australia's influence abroad, internationally, it's not performing as well as it was. And if you compare that to, say, China's influence in the immediate region, like, say, Southeast Asia, China is being quite influential in that in that region as well, that it may be a case of applying that sort of logic to an area like the Pacific, which is concerning because that's sort of where the majority of Australia's sort of foreign assistance goes into.
Interesting. Yeah, let's zero in on the last 12 months specifically a little bit more because the results of the survey are a reversal. I mean, this time last year, Australia was considered the most influential among Australians. So what's changed specifically over the last 12 months, do you think?
Look, there have been some key things that have been on our radar that we've looked at that have exercised Chinese influence or is a demonstration of that. One of the two key things that we see, I think the biggest ticket item that we could see in the Pacific is that there was heavy Chinese influence around the Pacific Island Foreign Leaders Meeting last year. And that was, while that was mainly targeted at sort of the exclusion of Taiwan in the meeting, it ended up becoming an exclusion of really all major development partners as well. So you had big players like the US as well, which is excluded from participating in the PIF, and it was only the main PIF members when they held it in Solomon Islands last year. The other one as well was the intended signing of what was a Nakamal agreement between Australia and Vanuatu, and that had been derailed as well. And there were hints of Chinese influence as well to sort of derail that signing, because that now, as sort of is uncovered now, and we're seeing, while Australia is now on the verge of signing a scaled back version of the Nakamal agreement, there's also on the table as well another agreement between Vanuatu and China as well that could be signed around the same time.
Yeah, that is really interesting. So I guess, what does all this say about Australia's messaging? Could they be doing more? And do you think China is at this point doing a better job at winning hearts and minds, or is it an intimidation element perhaps?
Look, it's really interesting, right? Like, you know, as it comes to exerting influence across, you know, other countries, especially across in the Pacific, it's not so much about winning many hearts and many minds. It seems to be more about winning the right ones, right? And I should have also mentioned that, you know, in the last 12 months, while China has had some sort of significant actions that have taken place across the Pacific, Australia as well has had some serious significant wins. And my mind sort of draws to something like the Puk Puk Treaty that was signed with PNG. PNG was sort of a key sort of point of contestation between China and Australia until Australia had signed the military alliance, the first one for PNG, and I think the first for Australia in the last 70 years. So there have been some significant wins, but the problem is, why is this not being translated into the confidence of Australia in the Pacific? And, you know, it comes a lot to the messaging, as you sort of pointed to. There's a clear distinction in which how China and Australia carry out their messaging of the work that they do. Now, for instance, China loves to put a lot of labels on the work that it does. Every Chinese construction company as well, signboards are up. They're littered across countries, in places like Honiara. They're littered across, you see in places in PNG as well, across the Pacific, really. China does this justice very well, even for, and this is a criticism that China receives, it does messaging for things that are not even funded by China. For instance, if a Chinese company is contracted by the ADB to do some construction for a project, majority of ADB funding is given through Australia as well. Mm. Now, Australia does not take that approach. It sort of shies away from showing that. It's almost given in an altruist, well, I mean, there are strategic intentions behind everyone sort of entering into the Pacific these days. But Australia sort of shies away from doing that sort of brash branding that China does. So I think it's time for Australia to really consider, you know, thinking about doing more, its branding a lot more seriously and not having to shy away from it. And at some stage, you know, I think being boastful is something that could matter as well.
Do you think the results of this survey would be concerning for the Australian government?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, especially after those major investments that it's doing, it's investing large amounts of money into the Pacific as well. And the perception of the Australian public that it is not exerting that sort of influence would be concerning, right? It has to go back to the drawing board. I don't think a lot has to be changed, and I don't think that it has to. We've seen a massive sort of step up by the Australian government in the last couple of years. I think it's more about getting that messaging right. But, you know, the silver lining to this is that, you know, it would rather have this perception held by the Australian public. I think it would be worse received if this was a poll conducted out in the Pacific, and that's how the Pacific people had felt.
That was Oliver Nobitau, the director of Lowy Institute's Pacific Islands program, speaking to the ABC's Kyle Evans.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
If you're just tuning in, Noa Mari Aetapen. This is Pacific Beat on Fridays, when the show is hosted from the islands. And today we're coming to you live from Fiji. I am Lide Movono. Our stories so far. Samoa's Prime Minister says his government will draft legislation requiring members of parliament to undergo drug testing. Tonga today is celebrating 200 years since Christianity was established in the kingdom. Fiji's Red Cross and the Ministry of Health are launching a national donor blood app today. And we spoke to the Lowy Institute academic Oliver Nobitau about why China is considered to be the biggest foreign influence in the Pacific region, despite Australia being the region's largest foreign aid donor. Still to come, a Kumul's Field London Broncos team is dominating England's rugby league scene, and we will speak to London Broncos fan page administrator Adam Perry. But before that, let's get some news headlines from around the region with our producer Vinao Funua next. Now, Amalolele, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Bola Lide.
It's been a while since you've done the news wrap with me, and I'm excited to hear what's happening across the region. So let's have it.
Before we delve into that, just some updates from the FIFA World Cup. Currently, Thurathau are playing Cote d'Ivoire. Cote d'Ivoire ahead by 1 point. It's nearly halftime. Likewise with Ecuador and Germany, nearing halftime, it's leveled. Germany scored in the first minutes, but it's now leveled 1-1. Later on in the day, we'll see Tunisia take on the Netherlands, Japan, Sweden, Turkey, USA, and then Australia, Paraguay. That game highly anticipated here in Australia. If Australia beats Paraguay, they qualify and move on into the later stages of the World Cup.
A few weeks ago, Fidel, there were so many Nivan One talks on the streets, you know, celebrating their FIFA World Cup teams. And I think Australia was the most popular jersey out there. So that's exciting to hear. But let's move to Papua New Guinea, where there is a risk of food shortage as a result of El Nino, frost and drought. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, this is a problem across the whole Pacific, but The Guardian reports Oxfam predicts Papua New Guinea will be the worst hit country in the Pacific from the weather pattern, with up to 3 million people affected nationwide. And according to this report, families, particularly in Papua New Guinea's highlands, are facing depleted harvests and the threat of hunger due to the threat of prolonged dry conditions. The effects of El Nino have already emerged in recent weeks, with drought conditions, declining water levels, and frost. Oxfam PNG estimates that 3 million people would be affected by this, including a projected 1.9 million in the highlands regions. Yesterday we heard from Tonga's Meteorological Service Director, Levi Fifita, talking about how the cyclone season could see more cyclones emerge. So very worrying.
Well, still in Papua New Guinea, HIV is continuing to ravage the country as we see 30 new cases reported every day. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, this is in Port Moresby alone. The National reports 30 new HIV cases are reported in Port Moresby daily, with most of the victims being women and girls. But Health Secretary Pascal Kase said that this could be the top of the iceberg because most cases are believed to be unreported. And he says there's a need for greater awareness. But with a diagnosis of close to 11,000 cases per year, 60% are female, and a lot of work needed to be done to address this problem.
Looks like we're going to be keeping in touch with our team in Port Moresby. That's Marion Farr and Belinda Quara to hear more about the rising HIV cases in Port Moresby. For now, always a pleasure to be talking to you again.
Binaka.
And thank you for our news wrap. Malo. As the Papua New Guinean chiefs build towards their NRL debut in 2028, the country's adopted club, the London Broncos, are dominating in England. The team, which features several Kumuls players, is sitting atop country's second-tier championship ladder with 14 wins and no losses. They return to the field this week to kick off the second half of the season, where they'll be gunning for promotion into the top-flight English Super League. To find out more, we're joined by one of the London Broncos fan page administrators, Adam Perry. Adam, welcome back to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me again. It's great to be back.
Pinaka, let's get right into this exciting story. Prior to this season, the London Broncos fans didn't have a lot to cheer about. Has that changed this year?
It's definitely changed. It's been an incredible year since the investment that we had from Darren Lockyer, Grant Wessel, and the Australian investors, and especially with our PNG army coming over for, as you said, 14 games, 14 wins. We don't know what to do with ourselves, really.
That sounds so exciting. I can almost taste the excitement in the air. But we're 14 rounds into the season. How have the PNG players themselves adjusted to this competition?
Well, they've adjusted fantastically, not only to the competition, but also life in the UK. The great thing about the supporting a team like the Broncos, we're still quite a small team, but we get to meet all the players. It's really sociable. Everybody's really close. So we've had the opportunity to get close to the PNG players and talk to them. And also a couple of weeks ago, not only were we winning games in the league, there's a knockout cup competition where we've made it to the final that will be played at the end of August. And we had the semi-final in Birmingham, the UK's second largest city. And all the players came into the pub after the game, and I knew that the PNG players had assimilated to UK life because I caught them all having a drink, a Coke, of course, and playing darts in a British pub. You can't get more British than that. So off the field, it sounds like, you know, it seems like they're having a great time, and there's a lot of them. So, you know, it's not just one or two individuals trying to kind of get to grips with a completely different culture and different life. They're all together, which I think must help them considerably. On the playing field, though, I mean, I've done my preparation these days. We've scored 900 points, of which a third of those 300 have been scored by players from PNG. Morea himself has scored 25 tries. So when you ask what impact the PNG players have had, well, everything, as you can tell from those statistics.
That is extraordinary, but also I'm so excited at the mental image forming of Papua New Guinean players playing darts in an English pub. This I've got to see. But look, still on adjusting, England has had extraordinarily hot weather of late. Have the Papua New Guinean boys thrived in those conditions?
We'll soon, actually, funny enough, every time we've had a few mini heat waves and they've kind of been in between games. So I'm not down at the training ground. I wouldn't be able to tell you how they're training in this weather. The rest of us are struggling, but I guess they must be loving it. We go, we play again on Sunday just as the heat wave is breaking. So probably good for the rest of the players anyway.
Probably will be. But look, we know that promotion to the Super League is the ultimate goal. Will that happen if the Broncos win the competition?
So that's a million-dollar question. We're hoping. It's unlike in previous years when there was a sort of promotion and relegation. Here it's about gaining points based on lots of different factors to gain a place in Super League. So that's based on like social media, crowds, engagement with the local communities, wins, of course, the grading of the stadium. And we're doing really well on all of these. So we were just outside Super League when it came to the previous gradings. So with this, you know, with the successful season we're having, you really, really, really would hope that we would gain a place in the top flight. Knowing the Rugby Football League in England, nothing is taken for granted. But I think that's what everybody's aiming for and everybody really has their fingers crossed for.
Well, we'll keep across that just to see the effort they're making to get across that line. But I've heard that the PNG Chiefs general manager, Michael Chalmers, visited the team recently in London. Mm-hmm. Is there angst among Broncos fans that the Chiefs might try and poach some of the PNG boys for the NRL team?
I think it's probably, you know, there's no doubt. I doubt it's in question that some of our players will go. We're desperately trying to cling on to them. And, you know, with Jason Demetriou, obviously, in charge here at the Broncos, the PNG head coach, we've got a great starting position. I'm sure some of them will, and you cannot blame them for one second. some of them will be lured away to pay for the Chiefs in the NRL. It's, I guess it's the pinnacle of every player's career to play in the NRL, not only that, to effectively represent your country in the NRL. So we certainly wouldn't blame any of them for taking that opportunity, but we hope we can cling on to one or two of them.
Look, you've had some huge wins so far. And in fact, the team won the last game at 134 points to nil. That's crazy. Are you confident for the second half of the year? Are you worried that they might get complacent because they've done so well?
I hope not. I think there are one or two of these results because there's a huge variance in skill level between the top and the bottom, and that's not the fault of the teams at the bottom, it's to do with investment. So there are one or two, you know, that 134-0 score was, it was an anomaly. So we're not getting dragged away too much on that score. I think what's really going to help us is having this cup final at the end of August. I think all the players want to continue performing well within the league games before then, so they get a starting place in that cup final, because we're all very excited. There'll be lots of buses on the way from London to Warrington, where the cup final is going to be. But I don't think Jason Demetriou would allow any easing off, if you like, within the league and, coming up to the cup final as well. It's not in his, you should see, honestly, he has he probably won't forgive me for saying this, but he has a face of thunder, sometimes at half time if we're only winning by a few. So I wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of him.
Oh, I'm looking forward to hearing more. Well, last time you were on the show, your Facebook fan page had exploded to 2,000 members. Mm-hmm. What's it sitting at today?
Oh, do you know what? I should have done my preparation. We've definitely got more. We have. I don't want to give you an exact statistic because I'll be blamed by my colleagues, administrators, for getting it wrong. But we've had so much interest from PNG and loads of interaction. It's tough. You know, our games are around about midnight Moresby time, so it's sometimes hard for PNG fans to keep up with it, although most of our games are live streamed. But it's been incredible. And not only, I didn't realize there was a very, very small expat community of Papuans in London. And we've had, we've been blessed by seeing some of those as well, not only family of the players, but what's incredible as well, and I think what's really sort of gained a lot of airtime and face time and social media is all the, the Birds of Paradise flags being waved at every single London Broncos game, both home and away. You know, I'm not sure there's been so many PNG flags in one place in the UK in its history. So that's pretty exciting.
That is so exciting. Thank you so much for your time.
More than welcome. Good to speak to you again.
So that was the London Broncos fan page administrator, Adam Perry, on the line from London.
Nijin Footy Friday. Join Sam and Tini Rao every Friday as they dive into the weekend's footy action and have plenty of laughs along the way. With insights from NRLW powerhouse Sala Tongatuki and Fiji Rugby Union icon Namani Kurundrani, you'll get the inside scoop on Pacifica talent making waves in both rugby league and union. Nijin Footy Fridays at 1 p.m. PNG time and again at 4 on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
That is all we have time for this Friday, but I hope you have something exciting planned for the weekend. But just before you leave, let's take a quick look at what made the news today in the Pacific. Fiji is launching a national donor blood app to help Fijians dependent on daily blood donations. Recipients say it would bring certainty to their daily transfusions.
You know, I wake up and just getting out of bed feels exhausting. You don't know what you're going to get. I don't know if I'm even going to receive that one bag of blood.
It has been my pleasure to host Pacific Beat every Friday for the last 5 weeks. I will be back again in October, so you'll hear more Mbulas then, but expect to be taken to the islands every Friday from now onwards. Until then, it's Faexia Ehanisi, Namaste, and Mordemanda from Suva, Fiji, at the Fiji Broadcasting Corporation. I am the ABC's reporter in Fiji, Lide Movono, and this was Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.